Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome to this week's Unbelievable Classic Replay with me, Justin Brierley, where each week we dig out a fascinating discussion from the archives. And this week I thought it worth taking a look back at what was going on in the days when the new atheism was ceasing to be so new and people were asking all sorts of questions about what would come next. Well, Alain de Botton held a view on the matter which certainly got people's attention and drew quite a fair amount of criticism and intrigue from many in the atheist and non-atheist camps. His book, Religion for Atheists, advocated an atheism 2.0, in which he even suggested there could be temples for atheism. Well, he discussed these views with the then recently converted Christian academic James Orr. Before we begin, a reminder to book your place on Unbelievable the Conference 2022, God Unmuted. It's all about helping Christians and the church find their voice again in an age where there's mounting pressure often to stay silent. It's being held at the British Library in London, and you can attend online or in person. We've a great lineup of speakers, including Alistair McGrath, Lisa Fields, Glenn Scrivener, Joseph D'Souza, John Wyatt, Phil Vischer, Sky Gitani, Sharon Dirks, Jeff Vines, as well as Calvin Robinson. And your ticket also gives you access to the live recording we'll be doing of our big conversation event, where Sharon will be in discussion with eminent brain scientist Ian McGilchrist on the question whether there's a master behind our minds. You can book your place at unbelievable.live. Now, on to today's show.
Well, welcome along to a special edition of Unbelievable today. I'm joined by Alain de Botton and James Orr. And, well, special because we're actually doing it out of the studio and in Alain's own living quarters. So thank you very much, Alain, for hosting us today.
Thank you for coming round.
It's great to be here. James, thank you for making it as well to North London.
It's great to be here.
You've been in the news a lot recently, Alain, talk of your latest book, Religion for Atheists. And we're asking today on the programme, should atheists be more religious? But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about your own background. Did you grow up with any kind of faith, or have you always self-described as an atheist?
I grew up in a very secular Jewish household, so identified itself as a Jewish household, but it very much approached life from a secular point of view. So that was my background.
Okay, and did you ever sort of toy with faith at any point? Did anyone ever kind of nudge you in that direction?
Yes, really not. I think for all sorts of reasons, it just never seemed possible. And I think that people tend to be quite loyal to their background. And I've remained loyal to my own background as an atheist, and I've not really strayed from that.
Well, we'll be getting into some of the aspects of the book, and essentially, you're a person who kind of obviously is a little uncomfortable with the direction that the major voices of atheism have gone in the last few years. Specifically people like Richard Dawkins, who obviously see faith as completely irrational and what's more dangerous in many ways. So tell us a little bit about what you're aiming to do with the book in terms of redressing the balance.
Mm. Well, I think it strikes me that the argument about whether one should or shouldn't believe is a slightly nonsensical one, because I don't believe that people choose their faith or lack of it by rational means. I think that one arrives at a position vis-a-vis matters of faith by processes which are fairly mysterious to ourselves. So the idea of attempting to convert someone, either towards faith or towards a lack of faith, seems to me, in most cases, not in all cases, but in most cases, to be by the by. We find ourselves in a particular situation with a particular orientation towards religion or not. I think it's rather like gender. You know, you either do or don't fancy a particular gender, and to try and talk someone into liking or not liking a gender, it's some of the same futility. So I think far more interesting than trying to wage that sort of battle is the question of whichever side one happens to find oneself on in the question of faith, what might one have to say about the other side? And as an atheist, I'm particularly interested in how one might view the religious realm. And I suppose the origins of my book have roots in feelings of doubt about the rather militant, aggressive kind of atheism which has been dominating the airwaves for at least the last decade or so. A vision of atheism which suggests that religion is a kind of insanity, a kind of soft-headedness. And as an atheist, I can't help but think that there are all sorts of things within religion which are deeply useful to one's journey through life, and that atheists would be well advised to be highly aware of religion in order to understand themselves and understand their own societies.
Well, before we get into some of the meat of this, James, let's introduce you again. You were with us back at the beginning of December in conversation with Stephen Law on that occasion. But welcome back. For those, though, who aren't familiar with you, give us a little of your background and where you are on the faith journey spectrum.
Well, I didn't grow up as a committed believer, and I think at university, in fact, I think I embraced a sort of an atheism, really, a form of atheism, a sort of soft atheism, I think. And in the period after university, whilst I was at law school, I began to consider the claims of Christianity, and I weighed up the arguments. I looked at the New Testament as historical documents as opposed to sort of purely mythological ones. And I came to the view that the claims of Christianity were fundamentally true, that they had a better purchase on reality than other worldviews that were on the table. But I'd agree with Alan. I don't think that one starts with a kind of a blank slate, you know, like sort of Descartes building foundations of how we think about the world, how we think about reality and our place in it. We're thrown into life. We're thrown into life as a journey, and we start to try and make sense of it from where we are. So yes, I wouldn't put too much faith in arguments of the existence of God or the project of natural theology. But I do think that one shouldn't perhaps give it as short a shrift as I think Alan does at the opening of the book. But I think believers have got a lot to welcome about this book. I mean, it does avoid the sort of scorched earth policy of the new atheists, you know, the view that of someone like Hitchens that religion poisons absolutely everything. And I think one of the great virtues of the book is that Alan shows that that's manifestly false, that there are all sorts of things one can learn from religion, philosophically, spiritually, culturally, which atheism doesn't seem to provide.
Well, before we get into some of those aspects, maybe it would be good to start as it were, where James positioned us, where you do start off both in the talks you've given on this and the books, sort of saying out of hand, well, of course, religion isn't true at a fundamental level. I mean, have you taken time to, for instance, consider some of the historical, philosophical arguments for the existence of God and contemporary arguments and that sort of thing?
Look, I have taken some time, but as I think I've said, it is about, I think, a psychological or spiritual orientation that one finds oneself in. Mm-hmm. So perhaps another way of putting it is not so much, I mean, I try and suggest in the book, perhaps I didn't do this clearly enough, it's not that I'm totally ignoring this question per se. It's just that's not my project at the moment. That would be another kind of task. And I suppose I'm quite a practical sort of person, and I move away. You know, before asking a question, I always ask myself, why is it important that one have an answer to this? Mm-hmm. I don't feel such a need to discover whether God does or doesn't exist from a philosophical point of view, because I'm happy enough considering that God does not exist. That's enough for me at this time. Mm-hmm. As I say, one could at another point explore this issue, but right now this was not my project. Mm-hmm. And because so much ink has been spilt on precisely this point, mm-hmm. I almost polemically say this isn't an important question.
Okay. Yes, and I think there's a great virtue in that. You know, transcending the God debate, however we choose to do that, whether we think that there just isn't really a rational basis for belief in God, or whether we think there is, but nothing is really going to come of it. I think it's a great, I think very sort of positive proposal. I mean, I think in the last 5 years we haven't seen, you know, mass ranks of, you know, mass conversions on either side. I mean, what you're getting is a sort of a deeper and more sophisticated entrenchment of views that are already held, and so we're clearly not getting anywhere. And so the question is, how do we move beyond this? Yours is one proposal, and I think actually believers might come up with another proposal. I mean, atheism for Lent might be quite a good idea. In fact, all sorts of religious beliefs at the moment could do with a little bit of purgation, I think, of some of the sort of more idolatrous conceptions that creep in, whether it's the prosperity, the God of the prosperity gospel, or the God of the philosophers, the God of natural theology. I mean, just how authentic is that God? Mm. When one looks at the biblical witness, for instance, in the case of Christianity. So I think it is absolutely a good thing that we try to move beyond the God debate.
Well, I think it's important, yes. We do a lot of debates, Alan, on my programme on the question of God's existence in various different ways. And only every so often do we kind of get onto the more sort of, well, how should we live our life if we were adopting a particular worldview? But this obviously is a book that aims squarely at that. Now, one of the news stories of the last few weeks has been the suggestion that you have called for temples to atheism. Give us the backstory on this. Sure. What's this all about?
That's really set the cat among the pigeons. Let me explain. I think that for many people, believers and non-believers, one of the most powerful aspects of organized religions is their architecture. It's, you know, the churches, the cathedrals, the mosques, mm-hmm. the temples. Mm-hmm. These are hugely beguiling buildings that really touch us in all sorts of ways.
And it's interesting to note on your wall you have a beautiful picture of the
King's College Chapel's
ceiling, Cambridge, yes, yeah. Which is a beautiful, beautiful piece of architecture.
So, like many believers and non-believers, I'm very touched and I'm very interested in architecture. And it strikes me that religions have always known that if you're trying to get an idea across, having a building could be very important, that architecture is a form of consecrating an idea, a concept, a disposition, and making it more real through that act. I'm saddened by the way that in the secular world, the idea of building an attractive building to a concept, to a frame of mind, to an attitude, doesn't exist. We don't have a category for that sort of architecture. You know, we've got the supermarket and the museum and the library and the swimming pool and the airport. But in terms of, you know, what's the secular equivalent of the church, the temple? Mm. We don't really have it. The closest we'd come probably is the museum, but that's not that close for all sorts of reasons that I can expand on if you want me to. But so essentially, we don't have an equivalent, except for in a few very rare occasions. Let me cite a few. The Rothko Chapel in Texas, a secular place of contemplation. James Turrell, the artist James Turrell, his sky spaces, you know, spaces in which to look at the heavens and have all sorts of thoughts. Peter Zumthor, Swiss architect, and some of his contemplative spaces. Tadao Ando, Japanese architect. Anyway, you can count them on one hand. Mm. Not very many, but fascinating spaces that essentially try and do to people a little bit what churches try and do. Put you in a different frame of mind, abstract you from the everyday, throw you back on yourself, raise some of the a space which supports some of the largest questions that humans might ask about themselves. So it's about setting a mood, and it's about orienting the mind towards certain things. And my suggestion is, well, atheists should have some of these places. Why, you know, why only the religious? Why can we not use the example of religious architecture, the extraordinary richness of religious architecture, to come up with some places where atheists might go, or non-believers, or also religious people, doesn't have to be.
Are they aimed, sort of, as it were, at the concept of atheism, or is it something else that they're reflecting in that sense?
Yes, I think, I mean, very unhelpfully, I said, well, you know, these might be called temples for atheists. Anyway, this, I mean, it was rather intriguing. I received about a million emails the very next minute by some very, very panicked atheists, who, many of whom spoke in rather personal terms about a sense of betrayal they would feel if this were to occur. And their complaint was, this will make atheism seem like a religion, and this is everything they hated. They hated religion, and why on earth did there need to be this importation of a kind of a religious work? So I'm sensing that this is an unhelpful term. So if one had to rename this concept, you know, one could say it's an artistic intervention or a contemplative space, or you know, whatever it is. Call it what you like, but I feel that this could be a useful addition to our architectural typologies.
Well, I mean, obviously, the famous atheist himself, Dawkins, responded, "Atheists don't need temples. I think there are better things to spend this kind of money on. If you're going to spend money on atheism, you could improve secular education and build non-religious schools which teach rational, sceptical, critical thinking." So, does he have a point?
Oh, you have to love Dawkins for his sheer grumpiness. and you know, he fell right into the trap. It would have been so much more interesting if he said, oh, you know, actually, atheists should involve themselves in architecture. No, look, I think on his part, it's a slightly knee-jerk response. I mean, of course we need to spend money on schools. No rational person would disagree with that, and etc. But that doesn't, it's not an either-or situation as it's presented. The real question is, should atheism recognise that humans have needs for music, for architecture, for community, for fellowship, all sorts of things that religions tend to do really well. Should it honour those needs, or should it simply stick to the rather narrow agenda of economic well-being, you know, satisfied personal relationships, and you know, trains running on time? I'm caricaturing, but essentially a rather materialistic, narrow vision of what a satisfied human needs. And Dawkins at this occasion was unable to stretch beyond that. The idea is, you just need a school, you know, don't be doing with these sort of buildings or anything like that, you know, and all that symbolises, the buildings, the music, the thing. And this is precisely my point against many atheists, that they fail to recognise that the school and the library and the railway station are not going to be enough to satisfy some of the more complex inner longings of human beings. And atheists are going to have to get a little bit more creative, I believe. And that one of the ways in which that creativity should be ignited is precisely by a proper attendance to many of the manoeuvres of religions.
I mean, you've described your philosophy as atheism 2.0, and Is a Dawkins and A.C. Grayling and the other sort of quite vociferous anti-religionist sort of atheists, presumably 1.0 atheism, being unhelpful at the moment? What do you think their contribution has been thus far?
Look, I think it's in danger of getting sterile because, as I say, the trying to prove the non-existence of God, though it's an intriguing project for a bit, you know, ultimately you just think, where's this headed? Surely the deeper question should be, how do we build a good godless society, rather than simply arguing that God doesn't exist? And that's the project that I'm interested in.
Well, what have you made of the project that Alan has in mind of a sort of narrow tower, I think, is sort of the description of it, in the centre of the city, James. Something to, as it were, contrast against some of the, I suppose, monuments to wealth and power and success in the centre. Do you sort of see some value in this project?
I think it's very interesting, and it has been tried once or twice before. I mean, I seem to remember from the history books, and just after the French Revolution, the revolutionaries tried to build a temple to I think, reason. I think it was still a cult of reason in actually within, revealingly, within Notre Dame itself. And not much came of that, unfortunately. But I think it's what interested me was not so much that Alain is suggesting we need the kind of architectural trappings of religion, but we actually, atheism needs somehow to make sense of the questions which are left once the purely negative work, the negative thesis of atheism has done its job. Mm. And it seems to me revealing, and I think quite suggestive for believers, it's not an argument for religious faith, but it seems to me that atheism, that the fact that atheism gets itself into the position where it needs to start coming up with answers to the great metaphysical questions by partly relying on the great religious traditions, is something which I think would make me quite uncomfortable as an atheist. It would certainly make me rethink my atheism a little bit, as I think you described very eloquently in your book. You underwent a crisis of faithlessness, I think, on listening to a Bach cantata or something. And I think, you know, I wouldn't want to sort of corral that into a project of, you've clearly sensed, this is an argument for the existence of God, this sort of sense of the transcendent and beauty. But there is something, I think, which would give me pause as an atheist, and which did indeed give me pause when I was an atheist. How does one make sense of the transcendent? How is one to give an account of the moral life in the absence of any place to anchor an objective distinction between right and wrong? You know, these are old philosophical conundrums, of course, and they've been people have wrestled over them for many, many centuries and will continue to do so. But it seems to me that it's, as I said, revealing that in the last, in its fairly short 250-year history, modern atheism, though it's been given the opportunity, hasn't quite come up with answers which are as plausible and consonant with human experience as one would expect if atheism were true.
I don't know. I think there have been many answers, but I think they're disorganised and they're not necessarily resonant in day-to-day life. I think that atheists have come up with everything that one might need, I think, for a good life. But it's not very well organised. Mm. And that could seem like a trivial point, but I think it's absolutely central. Because organisation is, after all, central to what religions are. They are organised bodies. And what they do is lend structure and guidance to what might otherwise be rather confused impulses and insights. Mm. So, you know, there are lots of conclusions that one might draw about how a good life might be lived from the writings of, you know, thousands of atheistic writers over the centuries. The problem is they're scattered everywhere. Mm. They're not eloquently and beguilingly stated in any one place.
Mm. Well, of course, there was that project of A.C. Grayling, to come back to him. He wrote The Good Book, I think, last year, and he did try to compile a sort of an anthology of non-religious life advice, as it were. Now, that had a mixed reception.
I mean, I thought it was a fascinating-sounding project, and when he announced it, I thought, gosh, this is going to be extraordinary and very nice. I have to say the book left me really puzzled. I didn't understand it. Like many people, I've had many conversations with people, and most of us thought, hang on a minute, have we got the wrong draft of the book? It was a very weird book. The book seemed to be rewritten in a pastiche King James Bible style.
It reflects the sort of chaos that you are, and the disorganisation that you were alluding to earlier.
Yes, that's right. It's in itself a chaotic,
it's quite messy and scrappy in a sense.
That's right. And simply just weird. Yeah. You know, it makes Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce seem like
transcendentally clear.
It seemed like a model of clarity.
Yeah.
So, as I say, I think the idea got lots of people excited, and they thought, wow, this is the book we've been waiting for. And then, because of the way it had been written. But look, I think the project remains an interesting one. Mm. Others should have a go. And, you know, as I say, there's all kinds of wise responses to issues, but they're not very well organized.
Yes, and you'd like to see, as it were, a concerted effort at doing the sort of job that religion often does quite well, of bringing things together in a way where people have spiritual disciplines, people have routines, architecture, art, music, things that connect them on a daily, weekly basis with the centre of their faith and the meaning that they have in their life.
That's right. I mean, I'm rather peculiar in being a great fan of Matthew Arnold's analysis, really, of what happens in a secular society. I mean, if we go back to the 19th century, Matthew Arnold observes Britain falling into a secular state, living for money and romantic love, and concludes that this is not possible. And his answer, you know, is he asks himself, where are people going to find morality, consolation, an ethical framework, community? Where's this going to come from? And his answer is culture, that what he calls culture, by which we should understand, you know, history, literature, philosophy, art, you know, all the most sophisticated responses to the human condition outside of religion, that these are resources that could get us through life, and that we should replace scripture with culture. And that was his project. And I think we catch echoes of it when people still speak very approvingly of the purpose of education, the nobility of the humanities, etc. Essentially, that's the Arnoldian project. But basically, it's disappeared. And you know, if you pitched up at a university now and said, you know, I've come to seek guidance, and you know, I'm studying philosophy to learn how to live, people call the ambulance or the insane asylum. It's just not what these institutions think that they're doing.
So, do you think that culture will get us there, though, James?
Well, it's interesting that Alan uses the 19th century example of Arnold's dichotomy between, you know, it's culture or anarchy, one or the other. I think in the wake of the 20th century, we need to be a little bit more hesitant about too readily associating culture with moral value or using culture as an educational tool. I mean, I was reading a book by a Cambridge scholar, polymath, the other day called George Steiner, who said that, you know, the icon of the modern age is the preservation of a grove dear to Goethe in Buchenwald concentration camp. And you know, there was a film last year about the orchestras that the Nazi camp commandants used to organise, and orchestras of inmates playing Bach cantatas and so on. And I think that it's an article of faith, this conviction that culture and moral value go together. And I think it's an article of faith that really flies in the face of the evidence. I think that, you know, prior to choosing which particular cultural artefacts we are going to use to educate educate people, is a philosophical decision. I mean, which particular thinkers are we going to use? Are we going to use Nietzsche or the Marquis de Sade for our moral life, Machiavelli for politics? No, we're going to think more carefully about which ones we're going to choose. And as we're going through that process of selection, we are appealing to a moral yardstick that is pre-cultural, that is extra-cultural, as it were. We need to think more, I think, more philosophically about... It will require a sort of a way of thinking that is, as I said, extrinsic to culture.
We'll allow you to respond in a moment, Alan, but we're just approaching the end of the first part of our programme. Going to be continuing our conversation with Alain de Botton and James Orr in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
You're listening to a special edition of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. We're also online, of course, at premier.org.uk/unbelievable, a popular podcast there, and links to where you can find out more about Alan's book, Religion for Atheists, and, of course, other resources associated with this programme at that address. Now, we've been talking about whether we need to kind of borrow from atheism, from religion, I should say, for the sake of a more coherent form of atheism that perhaps speaks to atheists in terms of meaning and life and etc. a little more, Alan. I mean, the thing that a lot of my atheist friends say to me who have come on the programme before is that you've got it wrong if you're trying to get from atheism a sort of mode of living, philosophy of life. That's not what atheism is. Atheism is simply a lack of belief in God or gods. And therefore, it entails no moral or philosophical agenda. That's something people can sort out for themselves. I mean, do you sympathise with that? Or do you think there is a sort of a worldview that atheism necessarily entails in some way?
Well, perhaps we're, you know, just playing around with words. The real issue is, as soon as you don't have belief, whether you're an atheist or you're just a secularist or an agnostic or whatever it is, but basically if you're outside religion, the point is you're not going to be facing only the question of how to deal with religion. You'll be facing all sorts of other questions: how to handle a relationship, how to look at money, how to think of your death, etc. And that's really all one's saying. So you're right to press atheistic friends on these other issues. And though they may well say, well, my, you know, the fact I belong to the atheist camp doesn't mean that I have to answer those questions. Maybe not on your show on this particular issue, but in general they will. The question remains open.
One thing that strikes me is that very often atheism, perhaps in its 1.0 form, does have a sort of religious backbone, and that is science, essentially, that science has become the religion of many atheists, and they point towards the beauty of science and the things it's shown us of the universe as being, if you like, transcendental almost in their beauty. It's the CERN Hadron Collider or something that is there, the most beautiful sort of item in the Earth, because of it shows the progress of mankind and all the rest of it. And even a kind of faith in the idea that science will bring us all the answers we need in life. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think that certain scientific phenomena can be contemplated and comfort derived from them, you know, the sight of the stars, as people have always known.
What is the comfort you sense when you look at the stars then, Alan?
Well, I think it all has to do with perspective. I think that human beings get into trouble when they see themselves as the dominant forces in their own life or in the universe. Being made to feel small is in the human playground rather an uncomfortable reality. You know, I walked into the hotel and the guy at the front desk made me feel small. You know, no one likes that kind of feeling small. But to feel small in front of a mighty glacier or in front of the stars or whatever, that's a kind of noble-seeming reduction of our own size, which alleviates us from many of the anxieties that come from living in society, chiefly envy and a sense that our will is being frustrated. Once you get into the context of the broader forces of the universe, your will and its success in shaping life is seen as totally puny anyway, and your ego and your achievements, etc. So there's a welcome reduction in a sense of agency. And, you know, you could call that God and you could call that science, but I think there's a real meeting point of what an atheist might derive and what a religious person might derive from the sight of these sublime spectacles. Now, the important thing about science is that, on the whole, science does not directly admit that its value might be in this area. The way that science is presented to us, say a Brian Cox program, or even a Richard Dawkins book or whatever, it seems as though the audience is being taught to become a scientist. We're being invited for a moment to put on a lab coat
into a form of life.
Yes, and that we will sort of get to see what scientists are up to now. My response to that is, I don't really care about the details of what you chaps are doing. I'm not going to become a, you know, nuclear physicist after watching, you know, a bit of telly. It's not going to work. So really what I want is just that emotional satisfaction that comes from a feeling of awe. And I don't really want to pretend that I'm doing anything other than that. So, you know, steady on with the astrophysics, because that's not really that interesting. And, you know, this is
heresy, though, to some atheists.
I'm
not into science and reason and...
Right. No, I'm into science and reason, but what I'm advocating is an aesthetic approach to science by many people. Not all people, because some people are actually scientists, but many other people. You know, you see, the Science Museum, the Victorians were quite good on this. The Victorians recognised that science had a value as more than just science, that it had a consoling function. And that's why, you know, if you look at something like the Natural History Museum, it is a temple.
It's designed as a church.
It is designed as a kind of church. But we're slightly moved away from that into a more sort of sensible view that science is really just about, you know, becoming a researcher. You know, rather than there's a lot of, you know, psychological benefits that comes from this. So, as I say, I'm advocating an aesthetic response to science.
James, I'd be interested in your thoughts on whether there is already a religious aspect to even atheism 1.0.
I think so. I mean, I think Alan's right, perhaps more so in the 19th century. I mean, Auguste Comte, who I think you mentioned towards the end of the book, had this slightly wacky vision of religion giving way to the age of metaphysics, ultimately giving way to the age of science. And he himself attempted something not completely dissimilar from what I think you're trying to do, setting up some sort of organized structure within which atheists could feel comfortable, coming up with, I don't know, altruism as opposed to agape and so on and so forth. But I do think that today science does seem to fill some of the vacuum left by religion. I think scientists do have an almost a quasi-priestly role in terms of the sort of their authority and the what they have to say about the nature and structure of reality. But I think Alan's right. I mean, you know, these terms are very slippery. I mean, I'm not even that comfortable with the concept of religion. I mean, I think historians of the idea of religion are pretty much agreed that there is no clear definition as to what exactly religion is. You know, any concept that can encompass Orthodox Judaism and Zen Buddhism is not obvious that a concept like that can do a great deal of work. I mean, are we casting the net so wide as to make religion effectively a sort of functionally meaningless term? And I think the evidence is that the notion of religion arises in the wake of the Enlightenment. I think before the Enlightenment, the religious life meant a life committed to monasticism. In the wake of the Enlightenment, religion is, I think, a kind of a secular construct which is used to control and contain Christianity and its institutions to open up a space for the secular. So, in a sense, I think religion has always been for atheists because it's something that was effectively came in the wake of modern atheism. I'd also, I suppose, be a little bit reluctant to talk about culture with a capital C. I mean, Matthew Arnold is a very good example of that. I mean, the definitional difficulties involved in coming clear about exactly what one means by culture is problematic. And of course, you know, it's impossible to go into the complexities there in a book of 200-300 pages. So yes, to answer your question, I mean, science does, I think, in many ways function as a religion in the modern age, perhaps not quite as much as it did in the 19th century, but I think again, as with culture, the 20th century has taught us some lessons about the limits of science and the abuses that science can wreak on the modern on the moral life.
I mean, one thing that strikes me is whether we lose something when we sort of take the trappings of religion and, as it were, say, borrow/steal them for atheism. Is it the same, would you say, having the practices, the architecture, without the fundamental belief that went into producing those great acts that kind of drives the person who does pray every day, read their Bible every day, or whatever it might be that constitutes their spiritual life?
I think that for a believer, it's going to seem at worst offensive and at best a bit odd that one might suggest that there are things that are available to the non-believer in religious practices and attitudes and works of art. But I think it's troubling but true. I mean, it's troubling. You know, if I'd paid for Chartres Cathedral as a mirror of the Holy Book, as an invitation to a foretaste of the kingdom, I'd see it a bit weird and there's only slightly offensive if a tourist pitched up with absolutely no belief in anything and declared the building to be absolutely marvellous and really, really stunning stuff. And similarly, loved a Bach cantata, declared the Mass in B minor their favourite thing, but had absolutely no time for the Trinity or the Annunciation or anything like this. So it's bizarre, I think, as an atheist, that we have to recognise that many of the things which are quite integral to religion have a peculiar habit of floating, of being able to float free of the specific meaning ascribed to it, to them by religions, so that it is possible to enjoy the music, to enjoy a ceremony, etc., even though one doesn't necessarily believe in the ceremony, even though one might not even understand what the ceremony is about. One could still get quite a lot out of a mass, but not know anything about what this religion is about, because you're enjoying the solemnity, you're enjoying colour, you're enjoying ritual, you're enjoying being with a group of people, etc. So I think religious people just have to accept that they come up with some very nice stuff that they do not entirely control, that they are really hitting on universal phenomena and have managed to distill, crystallize, create some very attractive responses, which, as I say, can appeal to people who have nothing to do with the doctrine.
It's fascinating. I mean, although what struck me, I mean, although it's true that a lot of what you're talking about could loosely be described as the trappings of religion, you do occasionally seem to stray into something, into wanting to borrow something which approaches, I think, a pretty fully fledged metaphysical commitment. So I'm thinking about the few pages you wrote on the doctrine of original sin. Not probably a very unpalatable doctrine to many, but I think, as G.K. Chesterton said, one of the few doctrines that doesn't require arguing for in the Christian faith. And there you're doing something slightly different from saying, oh, well, look, we just want the ceremonies, the rituals, the buildings. You're saying, no, actually, Christianity on this particular point is saying something which seems to ring truer to our experience of life, to our experience of the human condition, experience of our own moral shortcomings, that secular humanism, with its rather, I think, rather blandly optimistic vision of human nature, doesn't quite get. And that seems to me a claim about the way reality is. It seems to be a claim that is falsifiable, you know, one is truer than the other. I mean, if you're a Tony Grayling, you know, human nature, you know, barring the odd bouts of genocide and ecological, environmental, you know, economic crisis, we're all on the path to, you know, the sunlit uplands and moral utopia. And I think most people would want to reject that. And it seems to me that most atheists would be uncomfortable with that idea. And so what you're doing is you're taking something which is more than just the trappings. It's something that really goes to the heart of the Christian vision of reality.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a distinction. I am doing two things in the book. On the one hand, looking at the more external ritual trapping side. And then at various points, I do also look at the more psychological, philosophical arguments. And I think that there is in this area, which is closer to the kernel of Christianity, again, some concepts which can float free of their original anchor, as you say, the concept of original sin. But also, I look at other concepts, the Augustinian concept of pride, superbia, and our tendencies towards it, and that the problems with it. I speak in approving terms of Christianity's acceptance of the fundamental vulnerability of human beings, the need for a father, a mother, the need for forgiveness. I talk, as you said, about a pessimism and an acceptance of the sort of darkness. There are all kinds of psychological, philosophical points.
It's interesting, though, you with all this floating free of the anchor, as it were, could it not equally be turned around and said, well, this all seems to cohere so well with there being an ultimate foundational something that this all relates to? I mean, if we sense a spiritual hunger, could it be that there is something that will satisfy that spiritual hunger out there beyond just this material world we live in? You know, if we're not at home in this world somehow, just in the way we perceive it, then does that not suggest that there is something beyond this?
Well,
that perhaps all this is actually wedded to in a way that can't be totally separated out from.
I think this is where a lot of mid-20th century philosophy came to, and in that sense was much more sophisticated in its atheism than what we're seeing now in the minds of someone like Dawkins. Because if you look at the work of people like Heidegger or Sartre, what you see is essentially a kind of neo-Christian appreciation of what man is like without God. The step that these philosophers don't take is, not in all cases anyway, they don't then say, well, so in that case, that means there must be a God. So they take it as far, they analyse the problem of man in very religious terms, as it were, but they're looking at man without God, and the agony, the anxiety, the suffering of man without God. They don't then take the next step of thinking, well, because man is in agony without God, that must mean that God exists. And I'm very drawn to that position, the position of accepting the needs of man for God, while rejecting that must necessarily mean that God does exist.
I mean, I think those are wonderful examples. I mean, in the case of Heidegger, it's impossible to read something like Being in Time and not be aware of the enormously influential status that he accords to the Christian tradition. And here, what he's effectively doing is secularizing Christian concepts, the concept of angst and anxiety from Kierkegaard, of sin and fallenness from Luther, and trying to have, as you say, a sort of a neo-Christian vision of man in the throes of existence and not as some sort of logical kind of atomized construct. But Heidegger, towards the end of his career, is actually coming to something which is almost indiscernible from a fairly sort of fully fledged mystical and I think very, very religious attitude. I mean, the later Heidegger, I think in an interview that was published shortly after his death, he says, "Only a God can save us now." In the face of the creeping advances of science and technology, we need to orient ourselves towards what he calls being. But to all intents and purposes, it seems to me that, and I think many Heidegger scholars agree, that being is really just a placeholder for God. And Heidegger, I think, certainly at certain points, he can be read as wanting to purge of Christianity of all of the accretions that natural theology has brought about, to recover a kind of authentic, primal, existential Christianity. And this is why he quotes Paul so much. This is why he says that, this kind of, my kind of godless thinking is going to get closer to the real God of Christianity than the God of ontotheology and metaphysics and so on. It's funny, I mean, what strikes me as curious, ironical, and kind of paradoxical is that on the one hand we have a representative of the atheist tradition, such as yourself, wanting to appropriate the trappings of the great religious traditions, and yet coming from my point of view, reading a little bit of theology, they seem to be doing completely the reverse. So there's a very, very fine tradition of contemporary Christian theology. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was executed by the Nazis for his complicity in the plot against Hitler, called for a religionless Christianity, and that far from religion providing the kind of structure that we need, it's actually setting up a barrier between us and God. And not, he wasn't speaking in some sort of evangelical tone, as if we need sort of personal conversion and a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. He was saying that there really is, that the trappings of religion can really choke authentic Christian life and authentically lived faith. Karl Barth, probably the greatest theologian of the 20th century, absolutely hated religion. He saw religion as humanity's fumblings towards the divine, Christianity as God's movement downward from towards humanity. And so we've got an interesting crossover here.
That's right. I think that's a very good analysis. And I, like you, am struck by how much contemporary 20th century theology is really doing something which has been present throughout the history of religions, which is various people, of which Jesus is probably the prime example, declaring that religion is illegitimate, that the religious structure, the religious trapping is illegitimate, and trying to reassert a purer vision. And this just happens again and again. Breakaway movements, the Reformation is only one of them. But as I say, Jesus can himself be seen as part of that tradition. He was the reformer.
In fact, funnily enough, you may be completely unaware of this, but there's been a video that's gone viral on YouTube in the last few weeks called Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus,
right,
and something like 17 million views now. But I think that's very key, is there's a sense in modern understanding that
we don't want the religion, we want the relationship, we want direct access, we don't want the kind of the trappings, the rituals that sometimes inure us to the actual realities of these things.
I suppose, as a non-believer, as someone for whom that personal relationship is not going to be possible, I start from a different point of view, you see. I don't think that church service is spoiling this otherwise pure contact that I would have, or this Bach cantata is not getting in the way of my personality. Indeed, it's the closest I can get to many of these things. It's the outward manifestation of things which otherwise don't exist for me, as for many atheists. So that's why I think you will find this weird phenomenon that many atheists, I mean, I'm not alone in this, are more attracted to the trappings of religion than the religious.
It's interesting, though, because in a sense the Bible does speak to this to some extent. The book of Hebrews, I'm thinking of, talks about Jesus becoming the fulfillment of the Jewish law, that what was previously the shadow has now been fulfilled in Jesus. And it almost strikes me that some might argue, I would argue, for instance, that when an atheist wants those nice bits of religion, say, the music that seems to have that transcendent quality, the architecture, they're getting the shadow and not the reality, which is kind of that which casts the shadow and gives us those aspirations, those desires, that kind of thing to which all of that is aimed at. And I just feel, this is, again, very subjective point of view in a sense, but that if there is nothing actually there, it's kind of whistling in the wind in the end. It's as though this wonderful thing, which you reach this point and then you discover there's nothing on the mountaintop,
I think your puzzlement, you know, and you have the grace to say that it's a personal, subjective response. That's absolutely what it is. It's the response of a believer. And the response of a believer at some deep level is, you know, and I mean this politely, why doesn't everyone else believe? the point is, if you really are facing an atheist, which you are, you have to accept that atheist cannot believe. And does not believe. This is not going to. I mean, it might happen, but you know, the atheist can't make it happen, etc. So right now, as it were, it can't happen. So the question then is, well, what does the atheist do? What is on offer for the atheist? And I think that has to be the starting point. But I do understand that for a religious person, it's very hard to understand that. Essentially, the religious person thinks, well, why can't they just become religious? That's ridiculous. That's the wrong
thought. Well, that you're turning the husk into the kernel. This is the puzzlement. It's not so much that, you know, why doesn't this atheist just get it? Yeah. But more, how is this atheist going about filling the vacuum which is left once you do away with religion's traditional answers to the life's deepest questions? How does the atheist, for example, go about setting out a vision of the moral life that is broadly universal, that can foster a sense of community, that can make it happen that strangers meet weekly to come together and talk to one another? I suppose my puzzlement, I think, at least, comes from the sense that there's a rather, as we've seen from Dawkins's remarks, a kind of fragmentation within atheism as to what are the core tenets of its vision of the world, as it were.
But I think this isn't just about atheism. I think it'd probably be easier to say secular society.
Secular humanism or secular society. Not
even, how does non-believing society arrange itself? I think this is really the question. And my fundamental view is that there needs to be greater structure in the area of guidance. And this comes back to the point about culture, which we were speaking about earlier. You know, and you mentioned very acutely that, you know, if culture's so good, how come the Nazis happened? But I think that's an unfair charge because, after all, lots of Catholics, lots of Protestants were also involved in the Nazis. For every lover of, you know, Titian and Botticelli who supported the Nazis, there were lots of lovers of Jesus and St. Paul who supported. So I think that we just have to accept that diseased minds like those of the Nazis are able to cope with some pretty weirdly incompatible things, things that we think should be incompatible, but which can oddly float in the same mind. So you can both, you know, weep over a child's lost toy and, you know, kill 100,000 people that afternoon and literally not see a problem. So I don't think that's the problem of culture.
in order to have that, in order to make sense of why it is that human nature can, one and the same human being is capable of sophisticated cultural appreciation on one hand and terrible moral depravity on the other, I think that pushes us back to the question of what are human beings? How are we to give a good account, a coherent account, a plausible account of what it is to be human? And if there's going to be some sort of organisational structure for secular society, non-believing society, it strikes me that there needs to be some sort of common agreement, not necessarily completely universal, but some sort of cluster of commitments and ideals around which people can gather. And it doesn't seem to me that culture quite provides that in and of itself.
Well, look, I think that a lot of Christian concepts are floating in our society, unrecognised and unnamed. The very concept of human rights is essentially a Christian concept. Mm-hmm. Things like feminism arise from Christianity, as does the welfare state in many ways. It's impossible to imagine a welfare state without the tradition of Christianity and Christian charity, etc. So we've got a lot of this already, and it's working very well. So I don't think we need to reinvent the wheel. A lot of it's there already. But when you say, what model of human being do we need? There are some things missing. What I'm impressed by in Christianity is Christianity's account of how we do have within us extraordinary capacities to imagine goodness and to be good, and extraordinary capacities for evil and
the
crookedness.
The angel and the beast.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that this is not sufficiently recognised by essentially free market economics, because the model, I think, you know, we have to look at secularism and capitalism, and capitalism essentially works on the model that you know, people are free, rational agents, able to choose between things, and able not to get too upset by market dynamics. So that if, you know, a property developer happens to have bought your city and happens to have plastered all the walls with reminders to eat more chocolate, that should be fine according to a model of free market capitalism, because the assumption that human beings are very strong inside, are able to hold on to reason and guide themselves, etc. I am much closer, in my view, to what a human being is, to the Christian model, which is humans are like children. They're all very fragile and very easily tempted. So temptation is key, and I think free market economics does not have a response to the Christian idea of temptation.
We are going to have to take a break there. We're already running over time, and we'll have our last final wrap-up in just a moment's time. You're listening to special edition of Unbelievable, which we're recording at the home of Alain de Botton, who is our atheist guest on the show today. He's the author of many books, been described as a philosophy of everyday life, but his latest, Religion for Atheists, is aimed at his fellow non-believers, encouraging them to adopt perhaps the helpful aspects of religion without necessarily the supernatural beliefs. Our other guest, James Orr, is a Christian studying for a doctorate in philosophy at Cambridge on the history of ideas, and they'll be giving us their final thoughts in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back, and what a fascinating discussion we've had. And thanks again, Alain, for hosting us here at your flat. What has been interesting in the reaction to the book and to the talks you've given, etc., and indeed to the suggestion of monuments, temples and things to reflect sort of views of atheism, is that it's not only had adverse reaction from Christians saying kind of some of the things that we've hinted at today, you know, can you, you know, strip religion of its trappings and get the best out of it, but also from atheists sometimes as well. I think John Gray suggested that it's a kind of failed project. It's been tried to be done before, and we've got, you know, go into a cathedral for goodness sake and get what you can out of that. But Terry Eagleton didn't hold back in his review. I'm sure you're aware of it. He labelled it as possibly patronising the way you speak in the book, and even kind of peddling a very tame version of religion. He says,
quoting you, he says, "Religion teaches us to be polite, to honour one another, to be faithful and sober, as well as instructing us in the charms of community." And he writes, "It all sounds tediously neat and civilised. This is not quite the gospel of a preacher who was tortured and executed for speaking up for justice and who warned his comrades that if they followed his example, they would meet the same fate. In de Botton's well-manicured hands, this bloody business becomes a soothing form of spiritual therapy." Do you accept that charge at all?
I think Eagleton's got it absolutely right. And rather than trying to say that's not what I'm trying to do, my response is to say that's absolutely what I'm trying to do. In Eagleton, you're dealing with a Catholic Marxist who essentially looks forward to the day when the neat, ordered people will be killed. And when you know, the justice will appear as God and Marx's kingdom is realised on Earth. And until then, anything which aims to introduce feelings of community or aims to guide people, etc., is a palliative and should be rejected in the way that Marxists, when things like the welfare state were first proposed, people like Eagleton rejected it wholeheartedly. Why did they reject it? Why would they reject the welfare state? Well, they rejected it because they thought that this would be a sop to the working class and would prevent the revolution that he was after. And so if you listen to Eagleton on the welfare state, he sees it as a compromise. So along with the welfare state, along with ambulances, along with redistribution in taxes, etc., I fall under the guise of someone who's just trying to make things a bit nicer and holding off the revolution. To which I think, well, he's crazy. literally, he's crazy. He is crazy. And so I can't agree. And I thought that weirdly his review, though it was taken to be very hostile, was oddly really quite respectful because it absolutely understood what I was trying to do. And it was quite generous insofar as it recognised that.
I wonder, though, in quoting that passage, one thing that kind of I took out of it was this idea that you're sort of trying to take something, which James has been talking about, trying to, you know, the whole point is we're trying to divest us of this religious kind of accoutrements and get back to the heart of this, what was essentially quite a revolutionary message from Jesus and quite something that people gave their lives for, you know. And are we turning it into a kind of, this is how you will feel better at work kind of philosophy, as it were? It's kind of wrapping it in a very sort of...
Look, I think there's a very strong impulse in some of us, particularly at a certain younger age, to think that the greater the sacrifice, the better the sacrifice, and the more heroic, that to die on the battlefield with blood spewing from you is the noble way of life. And that those little compromises that one might make to make life better, those little efforts to help a child to have a meal or to help somebody across the road, is merely just a weakened form of a much nobler deed that you know, one should perform. I'm squarely with people like Jane Austen or George Eliot, two women, important to recognise, in aligning my sympathy with the vision of Christianity, which is not about heroics. It's about, if you like, the heroics of daily life. And that this is really where
the battles are fought and won.
And that it's too easy to be like an Eagleton and, you know, call for the Great Revolution. Well, actually, you're not being very nice to your three wives, not being particularly generous towards your children, not really paying attention to your students while waiting for the coming revolution.
James, any thoughts on, as we start to wrap up?
I agree. I mean, I haven't read the Eagleton review, but from his recent writings, it's clear that he sees theology and Christianity largely as grist to the mill of a pretty Marxist ideological agenda. And in fact, this was something that was very popular in the 1970s, known as liberation theology, that effectively the gospel is something which is primarily for the poor and the dispossessed. And although it's absolutely true that Jesus spends more than half his time talking about the poor and the dispossessed, to read it, to over-politicise it, is certainly the wrong way to go about things. Indeed, if you're a Catholic, it's now, I think, official heresy. So, yes, I think one can go too far down that road, though I do think that Eagleton's recent, I don't know if one would call it a conversion, but his sort of more Catholic approach has somewhat softened his Marxism from the days of the 70s and and the 80s. But no, I mean, just to sum up, I think this book is really a breath of fresh air after 5 or 6 years of really intolerant and muddled and false writing about religion from the new atheists. I think believers can get a great deal from it. I think it's trying to move the debate on in a way that it really does need to be moved on.
I think he's done your job for you there, Alan.
Thank you very much.
Alan, thank you very much anyway. It's been a fascinating conversation, and perhaps we'll have you on again at some point in the future. But in the meantime, thanks for hosting us here in your house. And thank you for the book. And if you want to find out more about Religion for Atheists, do check out the webpage where the podcast of this programme is available. I'll put a link on there for anyone who wants to find out more.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's discussion from the archives, and you can find all of our past shows at premierunbelievable.com. And if you register for our newsletter right now, we'll send you a free ebook, God's Not Dead, by William Lane Craig, on the evidence for a creator from science and philosophy. You can also book your place at Unbelievable the Conference 2022, God Unmuted. That's unbelievable.live. All the links are with today's show. For now, thanks for being with us, and see you next time.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.